39. Svetlana hugged her daughter as soon as she was clear of the airlock in Star Crusader. They were still on the ground, but the pilot kept the thrusters running all the while, ready to shift them fast if the local field showed any signs of climbing higher. If it exceeded 3 G's, the ship would be pinned down, unable to pull away from the side of junction box. Inside, the ship reeked of fear and exhaustion. Nick Thale was counting heads, making sure all 27 of the Eddytown survivors were through the lock and secured for takeoff. The ancient lander had never been designed to take more than a dozen bulkily suited people, but in the years since her last comet fall, Star Crusader had been stripped and refurbished as a passenger-carrying transport. That had been when there was still hope that the Fountainheads would permit, or at least not actively discourage, human exploration beyond the confines of the present shaft. Where once a large fraction of her internal volume had been occupied by deep shaft equipment, drills, stowed robots, suit ballast, spray rock applicators, decompressed and folded tents, and the occasional handy X-MERV nuclear device, the lander was now outfitted with additional seats, berths, and extra life support systems. Not that it wouldn't be a squeeze by the time they'd picked up Wang and the other survivors, but Svetlana wasn't hearing any complaints.
"I thought you were dead," she said to Emily. "When it happened, we didn't think anyone could have survived. I know I should feel sorry for the people who didn't make it, but right now the fact that you got out is all that matters to me."
"We didn't know what was happening to the rest of Janus," Emily said, tearing her way out of the emergency suit. "We knew there was something going on under Eddytown, but we assumed it was because of the accident."
"Some of it probably was. Not all of it, though."
Svetlana felt a bracing sense of freedom as she spoke the truth.
"I made a mistake when I talked to the Musk Dogs. They lied to me, Emily. They've put something inside Janus, not to tap energy like the Fountainheads, but to make it blow up."
Emily appeared to accept this unquestioningly.
"Why would they do that?"
"They're trying to blow a hole in the structure. Janus is their one best shot at escape, until the next moon rolls in, which might be a long, long time from now."
"And they didn't think to mention this to us?"
"I guess they knew what we'd say."
"It's still going to happen, right?"
"Looks like it. Bella's been advised to evacuate everyone. Everything we've made, everything we've built, every place that we've tried to make feel like home, it's ending today."
"I can't deal with this. It's too sudden."
Svetlana kissed the side of Emily's forehead and ran a hand through her tousled hair, straightening it.
"We're all going to have to deal with it sooner or later.
Where will we live? How will we find enough energy and power to stay alive?"
"We'll just have to figure something out, the way the Fountainheads did.
We'll be poorer, though, by losing the one thing we have that makes us worth talking to. In which case, we're about to find out who our friends really are, I suppose. How long before we're all off Janus?"
Bella was talking in terms of hours. "The sooner the better, I think."
"And you still came back for us?"
"I was hardly going to abandon you, was I?"
"Not you," Emily said. "But Bella. Why did she come back when she could have left with the others?"
"Ask her yourself,"
Svetlana said, looking over the heads of the evacuees, trying to locate the small woman she knew had to be somewhere inside. She drew a blank, then looked harder. Bella wasn't on the ship.
"Where is she?" Svetlana asked. "She should have been with you, after she handed over the last set of suits.
She said she wouldn't be sticking around while we got into the suits," Emily said. "I assumed she'd have come aboard ship before any of us arrived.
But she didn't. Didn't you notice?"
Emily pulled away from her mother.
"She could have been anywhere aboard. She isn't on the flight deck. Where else could she be?"
Emily looked affronted.
"Don't give me a hard time. I had 26 other people to think about."
"But Bella somehow escaped your attention."
Parry pushed through to them, steadying himself via an overhead handrail. "We're about ready to dust off, unless there's a problem I don't know about."
"Bella isn't aboard," Svetlana said.
He looked around, his expression hardening.
"You double-checked?" "She isn't here. She told Emily she'd be back on the ship before any of the evacuees."
"Who was the first through?"
"Elias Feldman's son. Bella definitely wasn't with him."
"Fuck." He looked stunned, as if the universe could not possibly be doing this to them, after everything they had already been through on this day. Something must have happened to her between the two airlocks.
"It was dark," Emily said. "If she'd fallen, stumbled away from the track we were following,
We were moving quickly, not paying much attention to what was on either side of us. Jesus, don't look at me like that. No one told us she was going to fall.
Easy, Parry said. No one's blaming you.
She damned well is, Emily said, looking pointedly at Svetlana. Parry reached for a helmet stowed on one of the equipment racks. I'll go back for her. Tell the pilot to keep the lander down until the last possible moment. If he has to leave, I'll carry Bella beyond the wheels.
You'll never get through that half-open door, Svetlana said. I'll go out in one of the emergency suits, same as Bella was wearing. Mike brought some extras aboard the lander, right? It's the only way.
Not going to happen, babe. Don't want you falling the same way she did.
We don't know what happened yet, which is why one of us has to go back to look. Could be she's just trapped or disorientated. She didn't know Eddytown the way we did.
Parry held his resolve for a moment longer before giving in. I'll sweet-talk the pilot into keeping us grounded for another 6 minutes. If you haven't found Bella in 3, you turn around and head back. That's not negotiable. Svetlana started removing her Chakri 5, ready to slip into an emergency suit as soon as it had assembled itself. She did not care who she elbowed in the process, or even hear the disgruntled noises they made. Barely 2 minutes later, she was back on the surface looking for Bella. Retracing the course they had followed before, groaning with the effort of walking through the high G-zones, heedless of whether or not she was repeating herself enough to provoke the machinery, she found her way back into the admin core, to the jammed door that she had not been able to squeeze through before. Now it was easy. It did not take long to find her. As Emily had guessed, Bella had fallen not far from the route that the evacuees would have taken from their place of shelter through the admin core to the lander. In the darkness, with all their concentration focused on getting to safety, it did not surprise Svetlana that none of them had noticed the fallen woman, lying amidst the debris and clutter of the depressurized building. As Svetlana put her hand into the space above Bella's fallen form, she understood instantly what had happened. The field strength was much higher there, 3 or 4 G's easily. One errant footfall into that region of influence, and Bella would have been ripped from her feet. She would have hit the ground with calamitous force. The emergency suit was not designed to protect her from that kind of harm. Nor had it. With great effort, Svetlana dragged Bella's body back onto the path without exposing herself to the field gradient. But even then, Bella was almost too heavy to carry unassisted. By the time she got her through the jammed lock, Svetlana had passed through every state of exhaustion she had ever experienced and into some strange new landscape of fatigue. Afterwards, she remembered very little of the journey. It was only much later that she learned that Parry had been waiting for her in a Chakri 5, ready to carry the two of them back to Star Crusader. Bella was dead. The impact of the fall had driven a piece of debris into her skull like a piton. But what, Svetlana wondered, did it mean to die on Janus? Aboard the lander, Svetlana insisted that they must do what they could, no matter how futile it might prove. Bella had died instantly, but even though her suit had been punctured, even though all the breathable air had flashed into vacuum, the trace oxygen in her body would have continued to trigger a damaging cascade of cellular processes. Those processes were continuing even now, still working their harm. Those last traces of oxygen had to be flushed out, the cellular receptor sites blocked. Moving more by reflex than conscious direction, Svetlana pushed her way to the nearest medical kit and ripped it from the wall. She fumbled it open and tugged out the Frost Angel kit, with its childishly lucid instruction sheet. They'd had better methods of immersion for decades, but the equipment on the lander had barely been touched since the settlement. Parry took her arm, squeezing it gently. It's too late, babe. She's been under for too long.
We can do this.
He spoke with a calm insistence. This isn't the way it's meant to happen. Frost Angel is for preserving structure before it collapses. In this case, the collapse has already happened.
Then we don't allow it to get any worse.
I know you want to do all that you can, but we've lost this one. Bella would have seen that.
Parry,
she said, her temper snapping, either let go of me or start doing something useful.
Babe,
she shouted now, loud enough that it silenced all other talk in the ship, even against the background of roaring machines.
Parry, listen to me. Fucking listen. Bella Lind isn't dying on my watch. Either accept that or get the fuck out of my way.
He opened his mouth as if to answer her, but at first nothing came. Then, quietly enough that only she could have heard him, he said,
"What do you want me to do?"
She lowered her voice. "Get her out of that suit, quickly. Get her into a hard shell so we can flood it with H2S and do it fast."
"Okay," he said, and started moving.
They had her in the suit, flooded with hydrogen sulfide, by the time Star Crusader touched down at Crabtree and took aboard the handful of people who hadn't already left for Underhole via the maglev. The people, as well as the BI robots that had accompanied them to the lander, were all carrying as much as they could salvage from Crabtree's Great Arboreta and Aquaria. It was pathetic how little they'd be saving. A few twigs from a forest, a few fish if they were lucky. But everyone who had left the city had taken something, often at the expense of their own belongings. Perhaps it was a pointless gesture. Perhaps the settlement could never be remade the way it had been until today. But sometimes a gesture was better than nothing, no matter how hopelessly futile it might have been. It was the human thing to do, as Bella had said. The twigs and fish were a promise that whatever happened here, whatever the next few days or weeks had in store, there was still a future. Somewhere else in the structure, they'd find a way to make Crabtree again, or die trying. First, though, they had to make it through the next day. By the time they landed, Wang Zhanmin was ready with the passkey, still hot from the subnuclear fires of its creation. They got their first good look at it as the robots carried it with reverent care aboard the waiting lander. It resembled an insanely complicated piece of abstract sculpture in delicate blown glass, a cylindrical thing the size of a jet turbine, ripe with intertwined pipes and flanges twinkling with chromatic flashes of refracted light, and yet conveying the sense that it was not quite all there. Clefts and gaps in its elusive shape hinted at missing structures, like a three-dimensional jigsaw with some of the pieces missing. It was only later that Svetlana realized that the Whisperer artifact was made of material from both sides of the matter gap, and that the missing pieces were in fact fully present, integrated into the whole by gravitomagnetic coupling fields and transgap energy ducts, sharing some but not all of the same spatial volume as the visible parts. On any level of analysis, the passkey was at least twice as complex as it appeared. The Whisperers, had any of them been present, would have seen the other half of the machine and wondered about the ghostly parts intruding into the universe on the human side of the gap. "I was expecting to deal with Bella," Wang said, with no apparent rancor, when Svetlana quizzed him about the passkey. "Bella's dead," she told him, the words themselves tasting sordid in her mouth, like something she needed to spit out.
"Can she be saved? I don't know," she said,
and for the first time she began to wonder if Parry hadn't been right after all.
"We froze her, did all that Exford would have done. Maybe it's better than nothing."
"There were times when you must have wished her dead," Wang said, and all she could do was nod, for the truth of it was unavoidable. Then he added, "But this isn't one of those times."
"No," she said softly, "it isn't."
They left Crabtree, pulling away from the landing pad, thrusting slowly so as not to damage the delicate-looking passkey before it could be properly cushioned and stowed. Through one of the lander's armored portholes, Svetlana watched the settlement fall away and below. From the high hab to the outlying suburban domes, the lights of Crabtree were still burning, as if there were still people down there. It would have been pointless and time-consuming to power down the community now, given its likely fate. But to Svetlana there was something wrong, something almost disrespectful about abandoning Crabtree in this way. After all the years that it had sheltered them, it was as if they had all simply tired of it and decided to leave on a whim before it noticed their absence. Life support systems were still running, oblivious to the fact that the city's human burden was now zero. There should have been some ceremony of closure, with all of the colonists turning back for one last solemn nod of thanks before they fled Janus completely. Even after all this time, it occurred to Svetlana, Crabtree had only begun to feel like home at the moment of its abandonment. From Crabtree they flew directly to the hole that the Musk Dogs had made and passed through to the other side of the iron sky. They traversed an ocean of curving black spiken material until the remains of the Fountainhead Embassy came into view, 20 kilometers over Underhole. Every now and then the black surface lightened perceptibly. From overhead, in the direction of the end cap, stray emissions were still reaching Janus from the next chamber. They landed at the embassy, using the sole remaining docking connection into the Fountainhead structure. The pillars buttressing the iron sky must have been absorbing some of the quakes from within Janus, but it was still trembling under the ship.
"It's not getting any quieter down there," Nick Thales said, after he checked the latest readouts on his old flexi. "If we were still in Junction Box, we'd be pinned down by now. We left just in time."
But they hadn't left, not really. They were no safer here than they had been underneath the iron sky. Sanctuary was still 2.5 light minutes away, in the direction of battle.
"Any news on the other evacuees?" Svetlana asked.
350 of them are on their way to the end cap, according to Jim. Some of them inside Fountainhead vehicles, the rest squeezed into Avenger. We should follow them."
"We'll wait for Jim," Svetlana said.
"I've been in touch with him. He said to expect him aboard shortly and to make room for a guest." Svetlana went down to the lander's cargo airlock. Jim Chisholm was arriving as she got there, removing his glasses to rub condensation from the lenses. He wore no suit, only his usual loose-fitting outfit of nondescript pre-cut-off origin.
"I hear we have a passkey," he said, like a man who wanted to get down to business.
"I'll show you. First, though..."
But Svetlana could hardly force out the words.
"Something happened, Jim. I'm so sorry."
He seemed to look through her, as if her soul had become a stained glass window.
"Bella," he said simply.
"She didn't make it. She died helping the survivors get out of Eddytown.
Nick Thale told me she'd gone inside to help them.
She died saving people. She got my daughter out of that place. Even after everything that happened between us, she still did that.
Nick told me something else."
He pushed the glasses to the bridge of his nose and looked down at her, over them.
"That you went back in to find her."
"You'd have done the same."
"The difference is I've already died once. You, as far as I'm aware, haven't yet had the pleasure. That took courage as well, Svetlana."
"I couldn't leave her there."
"Of course you couldn't. You of all people wouldn't have been able to do that."
"Because I hated her?"
"In all the years of enmity, I doubt that you ever stopped feeling some bond of friendship, whether or not either of you would have admitted such a thing."
Svetlana looked skeptical. "I don't think so."
"Then why else did you insist on going back into that building, knowing you might not make it out either?"
Svetlana looked aside sullenly.
"It didn't matter. We frozen her, ran the Frost Angel process, but we all know it's too late. She was hurt really badly, Jim, and she was dead for a long time before we ran the process.
They made me good again. Maybe they can do something for her as well."
At that moment, Svetlana felt a spiteful urge to remind him that the aliens had not remade the former Jim Chisholm, but had instead created a chimera of two dead men, of which Chisholm only formed the larger part. The glioblastoma had taken so much of his brain that the aliens had no option but to fill in the missing pieces of his memory and personality with what they could salvage from Craig Schrope. Bella, when she fell, had lost at least as much.
"We should be leaving," Svetlana said.
He looked out through the window of the cargo lock.
"Didn't Nick mention the other guest?"
Through the window she saw the rolling approach of a Fountainhead travel sphere, with one of the blue-fronted aliens propelling it from within.
"Is that McKinley?"
she asked, remembering the alien that had come down for Mike Takahashi's homecoming party.
"One and the same.
I didn't expect him to come back with you."
"The Shaft 5 Nexus arrived while you were engaged in Eddytown," Chisholm said. "They began to turn the tables on the uncontained.
The battle's still going on."
"It's not over yet, but it now looks unlikely that the uncontained will prevail. Luckily, it wasn't a large contingent, and they'd suffered some attrition during their journey here. McKinley felt it was safe to return here for now."
"Are the other Fountainheads okay?"
"Yes, although that can't be said for all the elements of the Nexus.
But it's safe to cross into the next chamber.
Let's just say it's safer, and leave it at that, shall we?"
They let McKinley aboard, squeezing the travel sphere into the last available space in the lander's already overcrowded cargo bay. Then they pulled away from the embassy, accelerating hard away from the iron sky, until it became nothing more than a black circle falling away beneath them, backdropped by the distant orange light of the shaft.
"You must have come here in a Fountainhead ship," Svetlana said,
as she showed Chisholm to the passkey.
"Why aren't we leaving in one? Wouldn't it be faster?"
McKinley thought about that and suggested it might be better if the Musk Dogs continued to believe that this was a purely human evacuation vehicle, with no Fountainhead presence.
"Apart from McKinley, it is."
"Not quite. When you landed,
McKinley attached something to the lander's hull. It's small enough that the musk dogs won't see it until much too late, if at all. But it'll make quite a difference to our ability to overtake them.
What did he do?
Loosely speaking, he bolted a small frameshift drive onto Star Crusader. It's a human invention, so don't feel bad about that. Chromis would have given the technology to Bella sooner or later, I'm sure of it.
A frameshift drive.
She remembered that the musk dogs had promised her something like that, in return for further negotiations. More teasing lies, she now realized.
Like I said, it's only a small one. Not enough to go gallivanting around the galaxy, but certainly enough to make a difference to the acceleration this lander can sustain, with its engines cranked to maximum.
She thought of the musk dogs, still somewhere between Janus and the end cap door.
Why do we need to overtake them?
Because they'll be hoping we don't make it through the door ahead of them.
They've already lost, if you've got the uncontained under control.
Chisholm looked pained. I didn't say we had them under control, just that things were going more our way than theirs. The arrival of the musk dogs, let's assume that we can regard them as strategic allies of the uncontained, at least until Janus blows up, would be a complication we could really live without.
So what's your plan?
My plan is punishment, Chisholm said. They reached the passkey. Chisholm ran his hand over the glass intricacy of the Whisperer instrument, as if luxuriating in the erotic contact between skin and sleekly transparent machinery. Once, his finger strayed into one of the absences where it appeared more machinery should have been crammed, and he withdrew them sharply, as if he had touched live wires or hot water. But the passkey was cool now, cool enough to chill flesh, as if in some arcane way it was self-refrigerating. It had survived transportation from the forge vat to the lander, so far as Svetlana could tell, and was now mounted on a rigid framework of perforated spars, hastily adapted from the kind of cradle that would have held a FAD warhead.
I can tell you one thing, Chisholm said, looking back at Svetlana. It looks real. If it isn't a functioning key, it's a damn good imitation.
Now tell me it works.
We really won't know whether it works until we see a measurable result at the end cap.
How do we operate the thing?
Point and click, really. Just like a garage door opener. Only the garage is more than 2 light minutes away, and the door's wide enough to drive Madagascar through in one piece. Otherwise, piece of cake.
If it works.
Yes, he said, as if the remote possibility of failure had only just occurred to him.
There is that.
The musk dogs must have their own passkey, right? How else would they hope to close the door after them?
The musk dogs or the uncontained.
So why haven't they used it yet? Bella said we'd need to start closing the door before we got there. Doesn't the same thing apply to the musk dogs?
They aren't close enough yet. If they started the closure now, the door would be shut tight before they got there. Not clever, even by their standards.
So why not just wait until they're safe and sound on the other side?
That would involve taking too much of a risk of Janus blowing first. They'll be aiming to time it very tightly indeed. And us? We'll just have to do better. Chisholm took hold of one heavy end of the machinery and applied a firm twist to it. Along lines of separation Svetlana had not even noticed, one part of the passkey rotated against another. Like some cunningly assembled puzzle, the shape of the thing altered out of all proportion to the change in orientation of the two pieces. A lemon-yellow glow spread through the glass whiskers and intestinal coils, edged in blue, wherever it met the abrupt disjunctions between different matter phases. The passkey trembled, as if it sought to break free from its cradle.
"It's working now?" Svetlana asked, astonished.
Chisholm touched a finger to his lips and whispered,
"Almost. One more twist and it'll be active, transmitting the closure command.
We'll have to point the lander in the right direction. It's putting out a very narrow beam, and if it doesn't touch the end-cap receptors, nothing will happen."
"A very narrow beam of what?"
"I'd love to explain," Chisholm said, with no hint of condescension, but unfortunately we don't have all day. Svetlana let him get on with it. There was nothing elegant or subtle about his intentions for the musk dogs. His plan depended solely on guile and misdirection, the hope that the musk dogs would pay insufficient attention to an apparently human vehicle, making a feeble attempt to reach the next chamber before Janus went up. The only other thing in his favor was the expectation that the musk dogs would do nothing overtly hostile, even at this late stage in developments. If they had been pressed on the matter by the other agencies in the Shaft 5 Nexus, the Musk Dogs would have expressed bemused and plausible ignorance about the transformation of Janus into an instrument of escape. Given all that he had learned of the Musk Dogs through McKinley and the other aliens, he knew the parameters of their slyness. They would claim that they had only ever been trying to tap Janus for energy, in accordance with the agreement they had negotiated with the human population. They would claim that they had been as surprised as anyone when their innocent tinkerings appeared to set the moon on a course for violent self-destruction. Of course, they were trying to reach safety. What else were they to do? If it had been within their means to help the poor, beleaguered humans. It was all lies, but the Musk Dogs had scraped through on lies before. It was one of the reasons they were so tricky to deal with. But if they were to keep up the pretense of innocence, they could not afford to take hostile action against Star Crusader while the rest of the Shaft 5 Nexus was watching events. Which was why Star Crusader was able to slip past the Gristle ship before the Musk Dogs paid due attention to its unusual rate of acceleration, but by then it was too late. Jim Chisholm made the final alteration to the passkey. The passkey shone a rich, brassy gold, and shook so violently that it looked about to shatter into a billion twinkling shards. Somehow, it didn't. Since there was no means of pointing the delicate instrument with the lander, Chisholm directed Star Crusader to shut down its engines just long enough for the whole lander to be used to aim the passkey's beam towards the distant target of the end-cap receptors. There was a minute of gnawing anxiety before word came back from the fountainheads that the door had begun to close. After that, it was just a question of making it through the narrowing gap in time. Svetlana could not find the self-discipline to sit around waiting for that to happen. Instead, she joined McKinley by the suited, frozen form of her old friend and former adversary.
"I did what I could," she said plaintively. "Perhaps you can undo some of the damage."
Even though he remained within his travel sphere, McKinley must have had some means of peering inside the suit, into Bella's damaged, pierced skull. His tone, when he answered Svetlana, offered little consolation.
"You did the right thing. It's always better to try and fail than not to try. But the damage to the orbitofrontal cortex is grave. Too grave for you to fix. You can't put together a mind with guesswork. You may resurrect someone, but it won't be the person you used to know. We've lost too many people today, McKinley. I don't want to lose another. You risked yourself to bring her back. Whatever debt you owed her, whatever debt she owed you, I'd hazard that the slate may now be considered clean."
She peered through the glass shell at the mass of swishing blue-green tendrils inside.
"You're good at this, McKinley."
"Good at what?"
"Sounding human, making all the right noises. You've been learning ever since you met us, and you've got better at it with every passing day. But sometimes I don't think you understand what makes us tick at all."
"I understand that you value existence over non-existence," McKinley said. "We have that much in common, at the very least. Take it from me. It can't be said for all the cultures you'll meet in the structure.
That's meant to be reassuring."
"It isn't."
She closed her eyes and drew in a deep, weary breath.
"I didn't mean to sound ungrateful. It's just, she used to be my friend. A lot happened between us, but not so much that I don't want her back in the world."
"I'm sorry,"
McKinley said soothingly.
"I wish there was something we could do. But organized structure is the most precious thing in the universe. When it is lost, it is truly lost."
A little later, Svetlana left Bella and the alien and climbed through the innards of the lander until she reached an inspection porthole, far enough from other people to allow her a measure of solitude. She stared back along the route they had already flown, trying to make out the distant dark speck of Janus against the dull orange lining of the shaft. They had overtaken the Musk Dogs now, gunning the pocket frameshift drive to the limit of its capabilities. The Musk Dog ship was just visible several thousand kilometers to stern, a tangle of gristle backlit by the glow of its own arcane propulsion system. The Musk Dogs, too, were pushing their ship to the limit, so much so that entire chunks of the gristle ship were falling off, leaving a radar trackable trail of fatty gobbets and meat-wrapped shards of broken machinery. The same radar also revealed that the Musk Dogs were losing the race to reach the end cap. The door ahead of Star Crusader was closing with perilous speed, swiftly enough that Svetlana had cause to doubt the accuracy of Chisholm's timing. She needn't have worried. Just after Star Crusader passed through the narrowing end cap, Jim Chisholm asked her permission to send a message back to the Gristle ship.
Why? She asked, frowning.
It's a matter of form, he explained. Doing things by the book is terribly important to the Nexus.
It was simple to arrange, and she had no objections. She had the transmission piped through to everyone on the ship, so that they could all hear what Chisholm had to say to the Musk Dogs. Once again, a silence fell across the evacuees. It was not something she would soon forget.
This is James Henry Chisholm, human representative of the Shaft 5 Nexus, speaking to the one that negotiates. In a very short while, you and the other Musk Dogs on your vessel will die. If you are not killed by the detonation of Janus, you will die when you are intercepted by the surviving elements of the Nexus, in punishment for crimes against a client species of that same Nexus, and for negligent actions that permitted the recent incursion by hostile elements of the Uncontained. This decision has been reached unanimously by Nexus Tribunal and is not open to appeal. However, since the Nexus is not without compassion, it has been agreed that you may transmit a final message into our safekeeping. The message will be archived until such time as we encounter any other Musk Dog parties or specified alien third parties that you may designate as the intended recipient. No restriction will be placed on the message content, and we will continue recording until the moment of loss of contact. Chisholm inserted a judicial pause before ending his statement.
We will be listening. If we do not detect a return transmission on this frequency within 5 Nexus standard time units, as measured by our clocks, we will assume that no message will be forthcoming.
When he was done, Svetlana asked him how long 5 Nexus standard time units was.
Just under 3 minutes, he said.
3 minutes passed with no word from the Musk Dogs, then 4, then 5. During the 6th minute, the radar witnessed something catastrophic happen to the Gristle ship. Stressed beyond the limits of its own structural integrity, it broke into 2 huge tumbling pieces. It stopped accelerating. Only in the 7th minute, as the end cap door was almost sphinctering shut, was a fragment of signal detected on the return frequency. Svetlana had it played over the same ship-wide speaker. It was a horrible, wet, phlegmatic sound, like something being strangled and drowned at the same time. Then Janus went up. Cams on the inner wall of the structure caught much of the show and sent images up the shaft towards the lander until the blast scoured them out of existence. For an instant, the detonation shone through the sky holes in 2 lancing beams of cruel white energy. Then the iron sky gave way, shattering into 1,000 black shards as it could no longer dam the upwelling energy of the moon's end. The end cap door had narrowed to within a few hundred meters of closure when the blast hit. A sharp needle of cruel intensity pushed through the tightening circle in the middle of the irising door, the pure white radiance stained with the trace elements of the dying Gristle ship. Then the door snapped shut.